Hello, welcome to the show called The Environment. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm going to be reading an article from the Sierra Magazine, the Fall 2024 edition. It is entitled Consumed by Data. The subtitle is In Virginia, the planet's largest proposed data center threatens local ecosystems. This article was written by Ashley Stimson. The pastoral landscape surrounding Manassas, Virginia, has been eyed by developers for decades. Plans have been drawn up and then dashed for a shopping center, an interstate, even a Disney theme park. Despite these pressures, much of the region has retained its rural character. Butterflies visit clumps of wildflowers. Turkeys and deer stamp out muddy trails. Foxes dart in between clearings as they traverse the region's forest. It is no accident that this bucolic scene of rolling hills and two-lane roads and horse pastures still exists just 20 miles from downtown Washington, D.C. In 1998, the Prince William Board of County Supervisors adopted a comprehensive plan to protect the area from the tentacles of urban sprawl creeping out from the nation's capital. But no one foresaw the threat that booming technologies like cryptocurrency and artificial intelligence would pose to this rural enclave. Data centers already occupy 8 million square feet of space in the county. If all of the proposed new data centers are built, that number could balloon to 80 million square feet. Some advocacy groups predict that the amount of electricity these centers would need is enough to power 5 New York cities. One project in particular is accelerating that growth. In a December 2023 meeting, the Board of Supervisors approved the largest data center campus on the planet, a project called Digital Gateway. It will include 23 million square feet of data center space across 2,100 acres of former farmland. The energy to run such a ginormous facility could require about 750,000 homes worth of electricity, according to the National Parks Conservation Association. Owing to a lack of renewable energy, much of that will come from fossil fuels. In terms of harm, the construction of this facility on land next to the Manassas National Battlefield Park will be a twofer. It'll undermine the state's goal to decarbonize the electrical grid by 2050, while also obliterating wildlife habitat. The twin threats have sparked opposition from local and national environmental groups, which are increasingly focused on the adverse effects of a growing information economy. Kyle Hart, who is a program manager for the National Parks Conservation Association, which opposed the project, said, "What do we genuinely want our society to look like 100 years from now?" Now, only a couple of lawsuits and the determination of conservation advocates stand between these pastoral panoramas and Digital Gateway. Now, while the lawsuits, which hinge on whether the county provided proper notice of the board meeting, while they wind their way through the court, the newly formed Virginia Data Center Reform Coalition has asked the state government to step in and prevent projects like Digital Gateway from being green-lighted once again. It's made up of more than 25 organizations, including the Sierra Club's Virginia chapter and homeowners groups. The coalition thinks the state can do more to reduce the impacts on the surrounding community and ecosystems. Julie Bolthouse, who is director of land use for the Piedmont Environmental Council, and a co-organizer of the Reform Coalition with Hart, said, "We need statewide reform. We can't do this whack-a-mole. We're not winning a single data center battle. Northern Virginia's zoning laws are partly to blame. The first data center in the region was built in the early 1990s by America Online. Bearing little resemblance to today's monstrosities, it was integrated into an office park, along with shops and restaurants. Bolthouse said, "It was honestly really desirable." So desirable that many counties in the region implemented by-right zoning for data centers, requiring boards to approve applications as long as the centers satisfy a few basic conditions, such as height and size requirements. Well, today, the AOL campus is a pile of rubble on its way to becoming another hulking center in the middle of what's known as Data Center Alley, a cluster of nearly 300 centers that together host 70% of the world's internet traffic. So in tandem with generous tax breaks, the area's zoning laws have resulted in the construction of data centers adjacent to schools, nursing homes, and housing developments. And that's why the Tippetts Hill Cemetery, an active and historic African-American burial ground, with headstones dating back to 1863. Tippetts Hill Cemetery is now surrounded on three sides by data centers. That's there why joggers on the area's popular rail trail now take in views of diesel generators during their morning miles. They're why many residents of Village Place, a tiny neighborhood in the once rural town of Gainesville, look out their bedroom windows to see the yawning gray walls of a data center. Hart and Bolthouse are clear. The Reform Coalition isn't calling for a moratorium on data centers in Northern Virginia, but rather a more circumspect and transparent planning and approval process, especially when it comes to power usage. Hart said, quote, "There should be a requirement that these impacts are covered by the industry," unquote. The coalition is petitioning the state to mandate that data center developers pay for their own energy needs, or ideally, run their facilities on renewable energy. In addition to their energy needs, data centers require water for evaporative cooling systems that keep the servers from overheating. A large data center can guzzle up as much as 5 million gallons of water a day. That's the equivalent usage of a town with 50,000 people. Data centers that power AI applications need even more water. For every 50 questions it's asked, ChatGPT requires the equivalent of a 16-ounce bottle of water. In Virginia, some developers have requested permission to tap the county's groundwater for their cooling systems. Proponents of the data centers argue that the burden on ratepayers and the drain on natural resources is a small price to pay for the tax revenue that's pouring into the county's coffers, money that can be used to improve public schools and aging infrastructure. But Hart argues that relying on tax revenue from data centers sets a dangerous precedent. He says, quote, "When your county is the data center capital of the world, your budget becomes so dependent on that tax revenue that you almost have to keep new systems in the pipeline to keep feeding the monster," unquote. So depending on how the lawsuits shake out, in a few years, visitors to Manassas may find themselves in a construction zone where dump trucks and jackhammers are the soundtrack to an afternoon hike, or maybe not. Thanks to the tireless work of conservation advocates so far, the turkeys and the foxes and the wildflowers of Prince William County still have a home. And that was the article, Consumed by Data. The subtitle was, In Virginia, the Planet's Largest Proposed Data Center Threatens Local Ecosystems. It was written by Ashley Stimson. Our next article is written by Jonathan Thompson. It's entitled, Beautiful Wasteland. Can we have our clean energy installations and our desert too? Here is what Jonathan wrote. In the spring of 1844, John C. Fremont dropped from the Tehachapi Mountains into what is now known as the Antelope Valley in Southern California. As he neared the location where my father-in-law Jim's house now sits, he recounted this, quote, "We descended to a kind of plain among the lower spurs, the desert being in full view on our left, apparently illimitable. There," our guide, stretching out his hand towards it, said, "there are the great llanos. No hay agua, no hay zacate, nada." Unquote. That meant no water, no grass, nothing. Well, Fremont's guide was mistaken. The western Mojave Desert had been home to the Kitimuk, Serrano, and Tatavium people since time immemorial. During Fremont's time, herds of pronghorn and mule deer galloped through the tall bunch grass and the brilliant fields of poppies. Joshua trees poked up from the plain by the thousands. Fremont considered their stiff and ungraceful form repulsive to desert travelers. Strangers often find the desert to be inscrutable, and misunderstanding gives way to fear and disdain. That, I suppose, is why so many have been so quick to sacrifice these expanses. Jim's place, called Dead Dog Ranch, has a million-dollar view of Fremont's so-called nothingness. Like many of the dwellings out here, Jim's is off the grid. Solar panels and a few golf cart batteries power the spread, not because Jim worries about the warming climate, but because he likes his freedom and wants to be prepared if that seething mass of 13 million people on the other side of the mountains ever starts to digest itself. Dead Dog Ranch will be a fine place for toasting the sunset of civilization. The view from Jim's porch is, indeed, vaguely apocalyptic. The ancient lakes dried up long ago, becoming dust-billowing motorhead sacrifice zones. Groundwater pumping and diversions desiccated the Mojave River, and the pronghorn died off or fled. And now it's a landscape of prisons and gravel mines, enigmatic industrial facilities, developers' broken dreams. But none of it can diminish the beauty that simmers amid it all, revealing itself only to those who slow down and pay attention. I often wonder whether Fremont's misunderstanding of the desert as a lifeless void was honest, or an intentional ruse to justify the abuse that would follow. The latest assault is playing out 30 miles north of Jim's place, near the mining town of Boron, where a developer is building a 2,300-acre solar array. So when completed, that facility will generate enough carbon-free electricity to power 180,000 homes. But it will also require the destruction of at least 3,500 Joshua trees. While some lament the trees' deaths, others argue that we need all the clean energy we can get to possibly save the Joshua tree species from climate-wrought extinction. But what if, instead of the solar panels displacing fossil fuel generation, the new clean power is all guzzled up by data centers and sunbelt air conditioners and cryptocurrency mining operations? What if the trees are mowed down only to have gas and coal plants continue to churn out planet-warming pollution? Will we commit yuccicide solely for the sake of Bitcoin and AI inquiries? I step off Jim's porch, wander into the sandy bed of an arroyo, and follow it into the nothing, I find delicate Indian rice grass fluttering in the breeze, and pink, purple desert sand verbena blossoms celebrating the recent rain. And there, on the crest of a hill, a scissor-handed anthropoid, the Joshua tree. It seems to be in motion, maybe dancing, maybe pleading with me to save it from the bulldozer's cold blade. But as I approach, I realize it is not looking for help, but wildly gesturing at me and my kind to, at long last, just go away and leave it alone. And that was the article, Beautiful Wasteland, by Jonathan Thompson. Our next article is entitled, Put a Lid on It, by Nick Kepler. It's in a section of the magazine called Notes from Here and There, so it's shorter than some of the longer articles. The burnt orange dirt road leading into the forest was new, but it already had deep tire tracks. Building the road had been the first step for plants and Goodwin workers when they arrived in Crown, Pennsylvania, a tiny dot on the map, somewhere between a vast state park and a vaster national forest. The road led to a single oil rig on private property. The well at the site was one of 19 that the state had contracted Plants and Goodwin to seal. A mechanical humming filled the air as the drill string, a snake-like configuration of metal piping, returned from its 1,000-foot descent into the ground, emerging piece by piece from a muddy puddle. Workers in hard hats and mud-splattered coveralls disabled a link and then hauled up another piece. Encircling the rig were all the vehicles and rusted industrial contraptions needed for an operation like this. This oil well was last used more than 80 years ago, probably. No one knows for sure. The drill string reached a depth of 1,080 feet, but Luke Plants, the third-generation owner of Plants and Goodwin, knew that many wells from Pennsylvania's oil boom went down 2,000 feet. He said, "You have to think like an oil speculator." Well, maybe the drill snake had hit some debris that could be washed away, revealing the well's true depth. But no, this one seemed to be 1,080 feet. Dressed in jeans and work boots and a crisply pressed shirt, Plants surveyed the site from behind black-rimmed glasses. He waited for a phone call from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, giving the okay to pour down cement. Many of these orphan wells that are earthen holes that were once used for oil and gas drilling that have no record of ownership or entity responsible for their cleanup, they date back to the black gold rushes from decades or centuries past. In 1859, an unemployed railroad conductor struck oil north of Pittsburgh. Overnight, swaths of land were punctured by drills. Within 3 years, production in Pennsylvania increased from 4,500 barrels a year to 3 million barrels a year. Boom towns sprang up, and then more lucrative wells in other states caused the oil industry to go elsewhere. The Pennsylvania wells ran dry, and the infrastructure was abandoned. The wells were not plugged properly, and there were no standards for cleanup. Today, orphan wells leak toxic chemicals into groundwater and torpedo home values. And according to the EPA, every year they emit 275,000 tons of methane, an especially potent greenhouse gas. In 2023, an orphan well was blamed for poisoning the drinking water of a township in rural Pennsylvania, and another caused an explosion on a ranch in West Texas. Estimates for how many are out there and where they are just as elusive as their ages. After the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law allotting $4.7 billion to plug the wells, 26 states reported 126,806 orphan wells. But those are just the ones that people know about. The EPA estimates that there are about 2.2 million unsealed in the United States, concentrated in drilling states like Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, West Virginia, New York, and Pennsylvania. For 48 years, Plants and Goodwin, based in Bradford near the New York border, serviced the active wells of Pennsylvania. The company even owned some of them. But when Luke Plants returned home in 2018 with an MBA, he began to transition the company to primarily capping. He said, quote, "Well plugging used to be given to whoever could do it cheapest and fastest, and I saw that there was a greater demand for more premium, high-quality decommissioning work to be done. So that's where we wanted to set ourselves apart," unquote. Plants and Goodwin retires active wells for oil drillers and contracts with state governments, whose pace of well plugging has accelerated with the infrastructure bill money. Pennsylvania plugged more than 100 in 2023. That was up from a few dozen a year previously. Plants has seen the ways that legacy wells can impede on rural and suburban areas. He has encountered wells that leak methane and noxious fumes next to occupied houses and small-town recreation centers. He has been contacted when commercial developments were halted because construction crews discovered an antiquated well. And he knows that sometimes people siphon methane from abandoned wells for home heating and cooking. He said, quote, "The historical oil fields of Appalachia really were never addressed while urbanization continued to happen. Now you will find wells in the strangest places, people's backyards, sometimes in parking lots where the well has just been cut off and blacktopped over, and it's only discovered later," unquote. Sometimes Plants and his crew find items like tree trunks and cannonballs stuffed into wells. He said that his own father is relying on bottled water because of leaks from an orphan well in Shingle House, another New York border town. In 2023, the first year of wide distribution of the infrastructure bill funds, 6,094 wells were plugged, according to the Department of the Interior. 1 year later, Plants has some concerns. "It all seems too easy," he said, quote, "There needs to be more oversight of these jobs," unquote. His company did everything possible to ensure that the well in Crown was adequately sealed, hence the 1,000-foot poke into the ground. But rarely do state environmental officials check on the work. Plants fears that less scrupulous contractors could do a partial job. As the crew was wrapping up, the Department of Environmental Protection called Plants' site supervisor. The agency was satisfied that they had reached the bottom of the well. Plants and Goodwin prepared for a cement truck to plug it permanently. One down, 2.2 million more orphan wells to go. And that was Nick Kepler's article, "Put a Lid on It." And finally, we're a section of the paper, of the magazine called The Lookout, a roundup of important news and updates from Sierra Club campaigns and chapters across the country. Road closure. In June, the Biden-Harris administration said no to a plan to build a road through the gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve, citing irreparable impacts. This is likely a key roadblock for Ambler Road, a 211-mile-long artery first proposed during the Trump administration. The road, including a 26-mile-long stretch in the preserve, would have threatened Alaska Native subsistence practices, as well as Arctic ecosystems and wildlife such as wolves and caribou. Then we have insufficient funds. The District of Columbia Public Service Commission denied a funding request from Washington Gas for a $672 million pipeline project called Project Pipes. The PSC determined that the project runs counter to DC's electrification goals and ordered the utility to file a more limited pipeline replacement proposal instead. Katie Meyer, the Clean Energy Campaign representative for the Sierra Club's DC chapter, said, "This decision marks an important turning point in DC. By rethinking the scope of Project Pipes, the PSC is preparing to align utility spending with the need for an electrified future." And then, winning wind. This past summer, the Biden-Harris administration announced the approval of its ninth offshore wind project. Once complete, the Atlantic Shores South Project, off the coast of South New Jersey, will bring America's total offshore wind capacity to 13 gigawatts of energy. That's enough to power 5 million homes. The nearly 200 wind turbines would help New Jersey significantly in reaching its goal of 100% renewables by the year 2035. And those were three victories from the section of the magazine called The Lookout. Well, we're almost out of time, so I guess I better say goodbye. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the show called The Environment. I hope you have a great week ahead. I hope you keep on listening. Bye for now.